I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
First, a few developments in the war with Iraq. It will take some time to determine whether Saddam Hussein is dead or alive. The speculation comes after a U.S. plane dropped four bombs in an upscale neighborhood of Baghdad, where military officials believe Hussein and his sons were having a meeting.
Doctors in Germany say Private Jessica Lynch is in stable condition. And earlier today, Jessica's father recalled their first meeting since her rescue in Iraq.
We said, hi, baby, how you doing? And she said, fine.
And this was the sound today from the Palestine Hotel.
Journalists reacting to the shelling of the hotel where many foreign reporters are based in Baghdad. Two journalists were killed. The Pentagon said the hotel was targeted after snipers were spotted on the roof.
Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post is one of the journalists staying at the Palestine Hotel. Now, when the hotel came under fire, he was, fortunately, someplace else, out at the 60-foot-deep crater in the neighborhood of Al-Mansour, where four one-ton-each bombs tried to kill Iraqi President Saddam Hussein several hours ago, tried again to decapitate the Iraqi leadership. Anthony Shadid now joins us from the Palestine Hotel. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Anthony, are there any indicators from your perspective, the sense of the street or from Iraqi officials, as to whether that bombing in Al-Mansour may have killed Saddam Hussein and or his sons?
You know, you do hear Iraqis talking about it. In fact, ask journalists what they've heard because they're picking up, picking up the reports on Arabic language broadcasts of BBC and Radio Monte Carlo. There's a couple of things that you can maybe, read, broader truths into. We visited the bomb site both yesterday and today. In contrast to the initial U.S. attack that targeted Saddam Hussein on the first day of the war, when we never got close to that bomb site, we were able to access this site incredibly easily. There was very little security. We walked about the site, watched the civil defense workers try to recover bodies that were buried underneath. Pretty much had a free run of the area, and that's, very unusual in a place like Iraq.
And what would that indicate to you, Anthony?
Well, I think the lack of security suggests that although there may have been at one time senior leadership there, there probably wasn't yesterday. You would suspect that if senior leadership had died at that site, if they were still buried underneath the rubble, nobody would get within a mile of the site. That wasn't the case today. We did have free access to it.
Anthony, how vulnerable are you feeling right now at the Palestine Hotel?
I think a lot of journalists here are uneasy. They feel a little bit trapped. On the one hand, we have the Iraqi government that has always tried to restrict our movement within Baghdad. On the other hand, we're on the other side of U.S. fire, and I think there is a sense among journalists to try to find the safest place possible to weather this siege.
Paint us the scene in Baghdad at this point.
There's been intense fighting all day. We saw it really peak in the morning, but it's continued through the afternoon. U.S. jets have been flying very low over the city. It's probably as much a psychological message as anything, just to give the sense that they're in control of Baghdad. When you go into the streets themselves, they're deserted. The two things that you can see being sold are generators and suitcases, and I think that says a lot about the mood. Generators because people need electricity in a blackout, and suitcases because a lot of people are still trying to get out of the city.
Are Iraqi officials still as defiant as they've been, even to the point of virtually denying the U.S. combat presence in Baghdad, or are you seeing cracks?
The information minister only appeared briefly today for a couple of minutes, and he pretty much said what he said in the past. But you're not seeing Iraqi officials paraded before the cameras as they were in the earlier days of the war. I think a lot of them have become much more reclusive and possibly going into hiding. Iraqi television that was able to stay on the air despite relentless U.S. attacks on transmission facilities finally did go off the air today, and I think that's to a large degree silenced the one voice that the Iraqi government had to people in Baghdad.
Anthony Shadid, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid is a Washington Post reporter. We spoke to him from Baghdad.
We turn now to Don North, a reporter traveling with the 101st Airborne. He's in An-Najaf, the Shia Muslim holy city, 100 miles south of Baghdad. Don, what's happening there?
Well, An-Najaf looks very normal today. The streets are quiet. All the markets are opening again. But under the surface, there's rather an interesting battle going on, I suppose, for influence with different religious and political groups. It's getting quite intense. And it's a dilemma, really, for the commanders of the 101st Airborne to know who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. Some of these Shiite religious groups are very close to Iran. And, in fact, some Iranian Shiite clerics have been seen in Anjanaf in recent days, and they're suspected of trying to foment a little anti-American feeling here.
We hear there might also be reports of chemical weapons discovered in that area?
Yes. This is really, for me, the first report I've heard of chemical weapons being found. Of course, the 101st have been going through buildings and searching for arms caches. And last night, a sergeant in the battalion I'm with came across a strange, unidentified device. It looked like perhaps a landmine that had been fitted with some chemical devices. But the chemical detectors went off the wall and indicated that this device had mustard gas associated with it. The troops put on their protective suits and gas masks and took the device, whatever it was, and it's being investigated.
Well, Don, thank you.
Okay.
Don North, freelance journalist with the 101st Airborne Division at An-Najaf, south of Baghdad. Outside Baghdad, the Army's 3rd Infantry Division has seen fierce fighting in the last 3 days. The unit's headquarters by the Baghdad airport came under missile fire yesterday. 2 soldiers and 2 journalists were killed. Army officials told reporter Sean Naylor the missiles were Iraqi. Sean is a reporter for the Army Times. He's embedded with the 3rd Infantry, and Sean is with us today. The squadron you're with, Sean, visited a jail. We should say some of what you saw may not be suitable for many listeners, but tell us what happened.
Well, the soldiers here decided to pay a visit to an enormous and fairly recently built jail slash security structure on the outskirts of Baghdad. And this is really a massive structure. It's really a series of compounds within compounds. But it seemed to have been manned or run by the Iraqi intelligence service because it was their stationery that was found in the offices there. And the most grisly discovery made by the soldiers was the corpses in one of the courtyards of 2 men who had been buried up to their necks. And then the soldiers speculated, because of the number of rocks that were lying around their heads, that they had then been stoned to death. In fact, one of their heads was actually missing, and the other appeared to have a number of contusions on it, consistent with being stoned.
That does sound horribly grisly, as you say. Well, Sean, I'm wondering, what kind of interaction is your unit having with Iraqi civilians?
A little bit more now than it has enjoyed in the last couple of weeks of fighting. Now that the unit is fairly stationary in the outer suburbs of Baghdad and is manning almost roadblock-type positions, civilians are starting to come up and talk to them. In some cases, they'll talk about where the Fedayeen are hiding out, where the Special Republican Guard might be, that sort of thing. Other times, they just want help. They want medical attention. They want their water or their power turned back on if it's been turned off. They want help with those sort of things.
Well, Sean Naylor, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Sean Naylor, a reporter for Army Times, embedded with the 3rd Infantry Division on the outskirts of Baghdad.
And now we're going to take a few moments to focus in on the still careening combat in Baghdad. We're joined by retired U.S. Lieutenant General Tad Olstrom, who is now director of the National Security Program at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Welcome, General.
Thanks, Bill.
General, U.S. troops still facing pockets of rabid resistance from snipers, from quick hit-and-run attacks, from rocket-propelled grenades. There are suicide bombers, too, throwing themselves against tanks. What does the nature of the resistance in Baghdad tell you?
Well, it tells me a couple of things. One is there was almost an expectation that we would see this based on what we've seen at other locations en route to Baghdad. Number two is I think it shows a breakdown of any organized unit-level action by the Iraqi military. It really is a guerrilla environment.
Now, U.S. troops avoided engaging in extensive urban warfare in southern cities like Karbala and Najaf. Does that mirror what's happening in Baghdad?
I think it is. You've seen the probes, if you would, and the symbology of being able to move any place in Baghdad, but not necessarily intent to stay there or to move, if you would, as a force through a particular area.
General, what's your sense of how the resistance is being led at this point? Is there a central logic to it? Is there somebody calling the shots?
I would assume that there is not the command and control that existed at the beginning. It's been broken up significantly. There certainly are elements of that command and control, but it is disorganized, and I think everything we've seen so far indicates that.
Disorganized but still lethal and could stay that way for a while.
It's lethal as long as there are people intent to protect the regime and have weapons and means to do that.
General, as an old, I don't want to say old, but as a retired Air Force man, tell us about how you think the decision-making process went. Four one-ton bombs dropped on a civilian neighborhood trying to take out Saddam Hussein, a decision made in 25 minutes.
The system is now there. We've demonstrated that in many cases. We just haven't seen as visible examples of that. But in fact, there has to be an intelligence source, an expectation. It might be special operations on the ground. Transmit, if you would, the fact that they have got a legitimate target with the coordinates. That transmission will go back through the system to the planning cell, who will immediately take a look at it. It may or may not have been a target that was on the list prior. The planning cell will immediately plan it and match it up with a strike aircraft. In this case, it sounded like it was a B-1 with four JDAMs on board. And that simultaneously a decision has to be made, and the decision will be made by a decision cell within the headquarters of the command that will probably include legal and high-ranking inputs, if you would. And immediately, as soon as that decision is made, it will go back to that bomber with the coordinates. The bomber is overhead orbiting, can probably deliver in probably less than 10 minutes once given the coordinates.
Would you bet that the original information came from perhaps a special forces guy on the ground or an Iraqi on the ground?
I would say it's a combination. Now, if it was an Iraqi, it would be an Iraqi that we have to have some trust in. So there still has to be some human touch to that input.
To finish up then, it's premature to do this, no doubt, but still, let's do it anyway. When the wars look back on, what would you think will be said about how the Iraqis conducted themselves? Have they behaved shrewdly against such immensely superior firepower or not?
I would think we will look back in this and say it ended up to being a relatively determined force almost throughout the country, and they showed that, but they were certainly outmatched from a technological standpoint. I think they were outmatched strategically and tactically as well.
Lieutenant General, retired Lieutenant General Tad Ahlstrom, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bill.
Retired Lieutenant General Tad Ahlstrom is now the head of the National Security Department at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government.
Just ahead, the dream, and maybe the real chance that Iraq's once vast southern marshes may be reborn along with the 6,000-year-old culture that flourished there.
And later, a profile of one of the architects of U.S. policy in Iraq, Paul Wolfowitz.
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
As U.S. armed forces raced across southern Iraq's seemingly endless sands in recent weeks, there was little, if anything, to indicate that much of that desert was, until quite recently, underwater. In fact, ancient Iraq, or Mesopotamia, had some 8,000 square miles of marshland, which is about the size of the state of Vermont, a vast network of lakes and channels, home to dozens of species of fish, birds, mammals, even lions. By the 20th century, the marshes had shrunk to a fraction of their former size, but they were still home to a flourishing community of people, the marsh dwellers, who've lived in the area for 6,000 years, traveling by boat instead of camel. In 1991, the marsh dwellers rose up against Saddam Hussein. He retaliated by draining and then burning their lands. Dr. Susie Alwash is at El Camino College in Torrance, California. With her husband, Azam, she is co-director of a small group of scientists and Iraqi exiles who want to restore the marshes of Iraq. And we want to welcome Dr. Alwash. Hello.
Thank you. It's very good to be with you today.
Thank you, Dr. Alwash. Could you start by telling us a bit about the marshes of Iraq and the people who've lived there?
The marshes have been there for thousands and thousands of years. Some of the most ancient human settlements have been around the fringes of the marshlands. And you can see in ancient clay tablets drawings of homes and the watercraft and the fishing implements and the ecosystem that's exactly the same way the ecosystem was 15 years ago.
Very briefly, how does a marsh form itself in a desert?
The topography of the area, as you've been seeing probably on the TV recently, is it's incredibly flat. And so the rivers basically just stop going and spread outwards.
Now, what about the marsh Arabs themselves?
The lifestyle deep within the marshes was one that was really based upon the reeds, which are the predominant plant there. And these reeds tower like 10 to 20 feet high, and they form very dense patches with some open lakes. And they would collect the reeds, feed them to the water buffalo, which provided the milk and the yogurt. And the dung from the water buffalo was used for fire. They used the reeds and wove them together into mats, and they wove them together into huge cathedral-like buildings. They fished, and they hunted the wild birds that would come there on their migratory path. And it was, to my understanding, a very peaceful and quiet existence.
Doctor, to recreate a marsh then, do you, in effect, just reflood the land?
Yeah, that creates a wet land, but not necessarily a wetland. The marshland needs the functioning soil and plants and animals all functioning together to really create the ecosystem.
I guess the point is that the water is still there. It's just been diverted into canals and held back behind dams.
Absolutely. There's two problems. There is the local drainage structures, which are very easily re-diverted back to their original pathways, which would refeed most of the marshes. Larger problems are that there has been a lot of upstream damming, and that requires more of a regional cooperative look.
Suppose it works. Will the plants and animals that flourished there before come back?
I believe so. There's one area, the area that straddles the border between Iran and Iraq, that has really only been desiccated for about a year. Mm-hmm. Within months of the reintroduction of water, you should see green reeds growing again. They actually come back really fast. And it just kind of depends on where the remnants are of the wildlife to come back and the birds to come back. And if the migratory shrimp and fish coming up from the Gulf, you need to make sure that you've got conditions right for them to come back for their regular spawning habitat.
Now, what about the marsh Arabs themselves, driven so cruelly away from this part of Iraq? Will they come back?
I believe that they will come back. I think that they may want different things. There is a population of refugees who have come from the marshes, and they're living here in San Diego, California. We've been talking to them about what they want from the marshes. And they want more than they used to have. They want education for their children. They want clean water. They want better health care. But they also want the traditional lifestyle within the marshes.
What do people you know who say they're going to go back, Iraqis, what do they tell you is the reason they want to return?
The life, the peaceful life. There are people here in San Diego living a very nice middle-class life. They want to go back. They're definitely going back. I know one gentleman just sold his business. He had been here for 5 years and was doing quite well. sold his business, and he is eagerly awaiting the time when he can go back and go back in freedom.
Dr. Susie Awash, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Dr. Susie Awash is an instructor in oceanography and geology at El Camino College in Torrance, California.
And this note, in recent years, the McDonald's Corporation has been expanding faster than, well, the waistlines of many of its fast food customers. But yesterday, McDonald's announced it's going on a diet, opening only 360 outlets this year, compared with more than 1,000 in 2002. The news follows 12 consecutive months of declining sales at the burger giant and the company's first ever quarterly loss reported in January. Talk about your quarter pounder. Mickey D's new business plan targets older customers with low-fat meals and restaurant decor that will have, quote, aroma and warmth. The company also announced another innovation, training its staff to smile and be polite. But this is also the company that won a famous libel case, then lost the publicity war when a British judge agreed with the defendant's claim that McDonald's exploits children, is responsible for cruelty to animals, and antagonizes unions. And McDonald's may be the only corporate brand that's ever contributed a new prefix to the English language, Mick, meaning cheap, mass-produced, as in McJob, a low-paid, dead-end job with no benefits. And McDonald's has become the flashpoint for anti-American demonstrations around the world. When the way to the U.S. Embassy is blocked, it's now de rigueur in many countries to head for the Golden Arches. Yesterday's announcement pushed McDonald's shares up 9%. But can the company ever return to its glory days? Parents with small children who see the Golden Arches as a refuge on car trips may say yes. Others have their McDoubts.
Would you like fries with that?
I do love the fries. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, David Gergen on the man being called the architect of the current Gulf War, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz.
Wolfowitz is like the canary in the mine. He's an early harbinger of what may be coming, and if he's greeted well, then they'll pursue that.
Also, burning oil fires, dust and debris from missiles and bombs. We examine the environmental impact of the war in Iraq.
These stories and a new anthology of verse born of the defining conflict of the 20th century, the poets of World War II, coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Officials at U.S. Central Command say they are hoping to get a first-hand look at the damage done by some powerful bombs in Baghdad. Yesterday afternoon, a U.S. warplane dropped four bombs on a western Baghdad restaurant where Saddam Hussein was believed to have been meeting with his sons. Lieutenant Colonel Fred Swan was the weapons systems officer for the B-1 aircraft that dropped the bombs on a suspected Iraqi leadership target.
For me, what I was thinking was, well, you know, this could be the big one. Let's make sure we get it right. I had a fairly inexperienced other WISO with me, so I was basically trying to make sure that he was doing his job right and that I was doing mine right.
Meanwhile, President Bush says that it is unclear whether Saddam Hussein has survived recent bombing strikes, but that the Iraqi leader is losing his grip on power. Bush is meeting with British Prime Minister Tony Blair to discuss provisions for post-war Iraq. A key component in the talks is determining the extent of the UN's role and the makeup of a proposed interim governing authority for Iraq. U.S. officials are reporting that a second journalist has died from injuries suffered during a coalition attack on a hotel in central Baghdad. International journalists were staying at the hotel while covering the war. Military officials say American soldiers were responding to hostile fire reportedly coming from an area of the building. U.S. Marines are advancing on a military airfield in the southeast corner of Baghdad. A Central Command spokesman says taking the field would help secure the city and keep high-ranking Iraqi officials from escaping. Meanwhile, Iraqi fighters mounted a counterattack in Baghdad. They crossed over the Tigris River in buses and trucks and tried to retake a key intersection, but U.S. officials say they repelled Iraqi forces. Also, an A-10 Warthog plane may have been shot down this morning. U.S. officials say the pilot ejected safely, was recovered, and is in good condition. Experts believe the spread of the flu-like illness SARS may be slowing. Chinese officials say the number of cases of SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, dropped sharply in Guangdong province during the first week of April. It has since sickened more than 2,600 people worldwide. Checking Wall Street, the Dow is down 10 points at 82.90, and the NASDAQ composite is down as well, 7 points at 13.82. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush calls him Wolfie. Some call him Wolfowitz of Arabia. Others say that Paul Wolfowitz, the number two man at the Pentagon, is the most powerful Deputy Secretary of Defense ever and the architect of the war in Iraq. A member of the first Bush State Department, Wolfowitz wrote a paper after the 1991 Gulf War, the first outlining a strategy of preemption, calling for military strikes to prevent the use of chemical or nuclear weapons against America, going it alone if necessary. 12 years later, that policy has become the hallmark of the current president's world strategy, pushed by Wolfowitz and fellow neoconservatives, former lefties who've moved to the right. So who is Paul Wolfowitz? Joining us on the line is David Gergen. He served in the Reagan and Clinton administrations and now teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome, David.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Paul Wolfowitz is one of the most interesting men in the U.S. government today because he has such extraordinary influence over U.S. foreign policy. He's a serious man who has been both an ambassador and a scholar.
But, David, how much is Paul Wolfowitz the author of the current policy in Iraq?
He's a major architect. He's not alone. The vice president has had far more personal influence with the president, but Paul Wolfowitz has provided the driving intellectual force behind the policy. He's someone who has believed for years, as long before he came into the Bush II administration, that Saddam Hussein was a menace, that he had to be overthrown. And more importantly, he's come to the view that the United States has a large role to play in bringing democracy to that part of the world and having Iraq serve as a model that will enormously change the politics, in his view, of the whole region, both for reducing the threat of terrorism and also providing greater security for Israel.
Well, his critics do say that Paul Wolfowitz is strongly aligned with the hawks in Israel, has achieved now a lifelong aim of diverting attention from a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis to Saddam Hussein, that this is all part of his private agenda.
Well, I think it would be a mistake to say that Paul Wolfowitz has succeeded in diverting attention. If anything, the Jewish community today is quite concerned about the roadmap that President Bush has laid out in working with Tony Blair. So you find conflicts over that issue.
Well, you spoke about Paul Wolfowitz wanting to bring democracy to the region of Iraq. Is there, as some of his critics say, also a grand strategy to target other countries in the Middle East, such as Syria and Iran?
There's no question that some of the intellectuals who float in the Wolfowitz circle do have a larger strategy here, do want regime change in Iran and in Syria, and indeed would like it in North Korea, but particularly in that region. And those neoconservatives, as they're called, are very close to Paul Wolfowitz. Paul himself has not committed publicly to whether he would like to see regime change.
David, is it too simple to say that conservatives are traditionally isolationist, while neoconservatives like Wolfowitz are interventionists on ideological grounds, as some are seeing with Iraq?
It is certainly true that the neoconservatives are different from conservatives, so that the traditional conservatives like a Pat Buchanan are now very much in opposition to what Paul Wolfowitz is doing.
Mm. Paul Wolfowitz has been sort of a quiet architect of the Bush administration policy, at least to many Americans. This past weekend, he was all over the morning shows, which has only added to the suspicion on the part of some that Donald Rumsfeld is just an aging figurehead.
No, I think it would be a mistake to see Rumsfeld as an aging figurehead. He's very much calling the shots. What I think is more important to see is that the Wolfowitz is like the canary in the mine. He's an early harbinger of what may be coming, and if he's greeted well, then they'll pursue that. Mm-hmm. So it's important to see that when Paul Wolfowitz appears on television, then the administration usually is trying out some ideas, seeing if they'll fly. If they do fly, that's where they'll often go.
David Gergen is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He served in the Reagan and Clinton administrations.
Glowering smoke from burning oil wells, now clouds, Iraqi cities from Basra to Baghdad, while the turquoise waters of the Persian Gulf are cut by and may be contaminated by hundreds of warships, the makings of environmental trouble that could long outlast the current war in Iraq. The United Nations Environmental Program, or UNEP, is currently monitoring events in Iraq, trying to identify potential risks as it prepares to provide technical advice in the post-conflict period. Joining us to discuss potential environmental and health risks is UNEP worker Michael Williams, who joins us in Amman, Jordan. Hello, Michael.
Hi there.
Michael, tell us first, what are the problems associated with the smoke in the air?
Well, we know that oil fires, for example, do contain a lot of contaminants, mercury, dioxins, furans, and many other things. That obviously poses a risk to human health and the environment. So far, we do see the fire and the smoke dissipating in southern Iraq, but there's still a lot of fire and smoke in Baghdad.
So this can cause long-term problems once the smoke is gone?
There is certainly that potential. We do know from past experience that these sort of chemicals do get absorbed by the human body, by human fat, for example, and can stay in the body for a very long time. And also you can measure the impact on nature, on biodiversity, and on wildlife as well.
We hear also of all the increased shipping activity in the Persian Gulf having an impact on plankton levels in the water. How does that work, and what are the problems associated with that?
Well, this is an indicator, the higher plankton levels, that there are greater quantities of nutrients in the water. This could be flushing down through the rivers into the Gulf. We suspect it's also coming from the greater number of ships. It's just an early indicator that there is potential for future fish kills.
Now, why would ships cause more nutrients in the water?
If they're letting out sewage, if they're spilling oil, all ships do release some sort of pollutants. When you don't have too many ships, that's not a big problem. It's when you have a very crowded and enclosed sea like that you could see a rise in pollutants in the water, again, causing an increase in plankton, decrease in available oxygen, and the result could be fish kills and related problems.
What are other potential problems, environmental problems from the war?
Again, we know from the past, Iraq has been stressed by environmental problems and conflict for the past 20 years. And so we know that if there is destruction of, for example, waste management systems, and then again a lack of investment in the last 20 years, that can lead to a lot of problems. We have seen in the past the destruction of chemical plants, of fertilizer plants, various industries that use hazardous chemicals and then release toxic waste. If those are damaged, then these hazardous toxic substances are released into the environment.
Michael, then finally, what then are the specific health threats that the United Nations predicts as a result of this war?
Well, we do know that one of the biggest issues at the moment is the lack of drinking water, and that can lead to a whole range of problems. And certainly my colleagues in other parts of the United Nations are very concerned about that. Because of some of the closure of electricity systems, and perhaps some of the damage from the conflict, we could see, again, waste management, wastewater systems not functioning properly, and that, again, creating health risks. We know that, for example, cholera often occurs when there's not enough fresh water available and this kind of thing. If we take certainly this conflict and the past conflicts all together, there's an incredible amount of work to do in Iraq.
Michael Williams, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Michael Williams is with the United Nations Environmental Program in Amman, Jordan.
Still to come, war veteran, poet, and former New York Times Magazine editor Harry Shapiro has edited a new anthology, The Poets of World War II.
You're listening to Here and Now. The Pulitzer Prizes were awarded yesterday, and as expected, a number of big city newspapers came up big winners. The Boston Globe won the gold medallion engraved with the image of Benjamin Franklin for public service for the newspaper's historic coverage of the child sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. But for breaking news, the small Lawrence Eagle Tribune took the prize. Lawrence, Massachusetts is an old mill town north of Boston, a close-knit community with many immigrants. Torn apart last winter when four young Hispanic boys from working-class families drowned in the Merrimack River. Jim Patton of the Lawrence Eagle Tribune was the first reporter on the scene. Welcome, Jim.
Yeah, good afternoon, though.
Jim, remind me what happened on the Merrimack River that day.
Well, there were a group of young children out on the ice. One of them went through the ice, and several of them tried to form a human chain to rescue their friend. And as a result of that, four of them died. They drowned.
You know, such a tragedy. I actually covered that story, and it seemed as if the way the river looked, the way the day looked, almost seemed right for such a horrible thing to happen, a gray day with a coating of icy snow. Describe the scene for us when you got there.
Well, when I got there, this was a location just off of Water Street, which runs, you know, parallel to the Merrimack River. It was dark out already because of the time of year it was. There was a driving rain. That's all I can remember is this driving rainstorm. When I got to the actual location, it was mud. You know, there was a big high berm that you walked up to the top of and you could look down into the river. And virtually moments after I arrived, the young kids who had been taken to the hospital revealed to the people that brought them there that they weren't just looking for one missing child, they were looking for four. I mean, the scene was chaotic. There were dive teams, there were police officers, everybody was going into the water trying to find these children.
What happens to a reporter facing a scene like that? There's a part of you that's reporting it, and what about the part of you that's a human being that's realizing something so horrible has happened?
Well, I've always said that when I can't be moved by a situation, obviously realize you're in the middle of a tragedy. It's akin to having to visit the family of someone who has just been killed in a car accident or some other tragedy has befallen them. When you can no longer be moved by that, you know, it might be time to look for another job.
The boys tried to save each other, didn't they?
They did, and that was the heroic part of this. The one child that went through the ice, and they put three or four boys out there, and they threw a jacket to them and tried and tried and tried, and they just couldn't get them out of the ice, and then the ice went out from underneath them as well.
Jim, this is a day of a kind of jubilation, I guess, in the Lawrence Eagle Tribune newsroom. What are your feelings to win perhaps the most, probably the most prestigious award in journalism for covering something that for other people was the most horrible thing that ever happened to them?
Well, I think that while it is an honor to win the Pulitzer, believe me, when you're standing out there covering a big event like this, there's no doubt that when that kind of a thing happens, you know it's going to be big. And you're not thinking in terms at that point of maybe this will win a prize. You just don't think of that, and you're just doing the best you can to be the best. I've always felt that if a large event, a significant event like this happens in our backyard here at the Eagle Tribune, we damn well better be the best and have the best coverage.
Lawrence Eagle Tribune. Circulation, Jim?
Right around 55,000.
A great reporting job, a Pulitzer for breaking news reporting. Jim Patton of the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We spoke to Jim Patton of the Lawrence Eagle Tribune in Massachusetts from the newsroom of the newspaper.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Millions of people around the world died in World War II. Millions. And hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers gave their lives. The enormity is difficult to grasp, but sometimes it takes just a few well-chosen words. A new anthology coming out this month includes 120 poems from World War II. The book is part of the Library of America's new series of poetry collections and is called simply Poets of World War II. The book was edited by Harvey Shapiro. During World War II, he served with the 50th Air Force, 347th Squadron, 99th Bomb Group. He was based in Italy. He flew 35 missions over Germany and Austria as radio gunner in a B-17. And he is former editor of the New York Times Magazine and Book Review. So Harvey Shapiro joins us from the studios of WNYC in Manhattan to talk about his collection. Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you.
I want to mention first that we have said you are a gunner. And there's one very famous World War II poem, it's only five lines long, that you actually write, you related to in your own training.
Yes, this is probably the best known of the poems to come out of World War II. It's called The Death of the Ball Turret Gunner, and it was written by Randall Jarrell, who's probably the most famous poet to come out of the Second World War. And this is the way it goes. From my mother's sleep, I fell into the state. And I hunched in its belly till my wet fur froze. 6 miles from Earth, loosed from its dream of life, I woke to black flak and the nightmare fighters. When I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose. Now, the ball turret was a little glass bubble that projected from the underbelly of the B-17. And it was indeed, as this poem says, a very dangerous position to have. And I remember when I was in gunnery school, and we were being instructed by a sergeant from the 8th Air Force who had completed his missions flying out of England. And he was standing in front of a mock-up of a B-17 and pointing out to us the different positions a gunner might have in that plane, waist gun, tail gun, etc. And then he pointed to the ball turret, and he said, sometimes when they come back, they wash him out of the turret with a hose. I suspect that Jarrell, who never went overseas but stayed in the States as an instructor, heard that line just the way I heard it from a returning veteran.
You say that there are those who think that World War I left a monument of poetry, mostly British poets, and that World War II didn't, but that your belief is that World War II did produce a body of work that is clean and powerfully eloquent, and that poem that you just read us would seem to speak to that.
Yes, well, the poems that came out of World War I were written by, the famous poems were written by Englishmen, gentlemen, officers, men like Robert Graves, Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon, whereas the American poems of World War II are written by enlisted men, officers, Ivy League school graduates, farm boys, working class kids. It's a very different body of work. It's raunchier, it's bawdy, and of course it doesn't have the glow of patriotism that the poems of the First World War do, at least those poems were written before the terrible battles of the Somme.
I was surprised to read that and then to see it in reading the poems, because you have the sense of World War II, you know, all the patriotic music and the, you know, you felt that there was a sense of patriotism in the culture, and you're right, it doesn't seem to be reflected in the poems.
Well, you know, I remember at the time that, I mean, this country was pretty much dragged into war, shocked into war by Pearl Harbor. But there was a great anti-war feeling before we entered the war. And those of us who were in it, you know, we didn't tend to glorify our brothers. We were yanked out of civilian life. We thought it was a just war. We wanted to do our job. But it isn't that we did it with relish. And we certainly didn't like being put cheek by jowl with so many men that we'd never known.
There's so many poets here. I'm looking at James Dickey's The Firebombing. It's several pages long. It seemed to be about his guilt about participating in the bombing of a small Japanese town.
Yeah, that's a famous, The Firebombing is one of the best poems of aerial warfare. The aerial warfare poems, I think, mark the poetry of the Second World War the way poems that have trench imagery mark the poetry of the First World War. And this poem, which was written some years after the event, you know, he's now kind of homeowner, looking back and thinking of all the destruction that he was responsible for.
And others are also somewhat critical of the war, I guess, May Sarton's Navigators.
Well, so the volume does include some work by conscientious objectors that are just, you know, there's a couple of poems by William Stafford and some poems by Robert Lowell when he was in his fire-breathing Catholic CO phase.
Some tell a tale, as James Dickey does, and some, I'm thinking of Nabokov's eight-line poem, is just plain poignant.
Yeah, it's quite lovely. Shall I read it?
Please.
When he was small, when he would fall, on sand or carpet he would lie quite flat and still until he knew what he would do, get up or cry. After the battle, flat and still upon a hillside, now he lies, but there is nothing to decide, for he can neither cry nor rise.
That's heartbreaking. In its simplicity. Did he serve?
Oh, no. There are civilian poets that I've included in this anthology, like May Sarton and Nabokov, because they have interesting things to say. They experienced the war on the home front. But I give the most space, I think, to those poets who actually were in combat.
Would you do us a favor? You say that your point in collecting these poems is not to have a book of celebration unless it is to celebrate man's ability, indeed his compulsion, to turn terror into art. Could you pick out for us a couple of lines from the anthology where you think that's illustrated?
Okay.
Yeah, take your time.
Let's look at George Oppen's work. There's a poem called Survival Infantry. I mean, it shows how we were all wrenched out of the world we knew, but it has some of that terror in it. Mm. Survival infantry. And the world changed. There had been trees and people, sidewalks and roads. There were fish in the sea. Where did all the rocks come from? And the smell of explosives, iron standing in mud. We crawled everywhere on the ground without seeing the earth again. We were ashamed of our half-life and our misery. We saw that everything had died. And the letters came. People who addressed us through our lives, they left us gasping and in tears, in the same mud, in the terrible ground.
Harvey Shapiro, thank you.
Thank you.
Harvey Shapiro is editor of the new anthology, Poets of World War II. For more information about the American Poets Project or the book, visit our website here-now.org.
Before we go, here's a roundup of today's news on the war with Iraq.
Questions remain as to whether or not Saddam Hussein and his two sons died after bombs designed to penetrate underground bunkers hit an area where U.S. military officials believe the three were meeting. But Iraq's U.N. ambassador said he believes Saddam Hussein is still alive and that the Iraqi government is still in control of the country.
Captain Chris Wachter was the pilot of the B-1 that dropped the bombs.
You knew you struck your targets, but then you find out what they are, especially something like this. It's a feather in the cap. It's a good feeling.
Airstrikes continue today in Baghdad. An office of the Arab TV network Al Jazeera was hit, killing one staffer. And the Palestine Hotel, the home base for many foreign journalists, was struck by U.S. tank fire. Two journalists, one from Reuters, the other from the Spanish network Telecinco, were killed. The Pentagon said the hotel was targeted after snipers with binoculars were spotted on the roof. Journalists like NPR's Ann Garrels point out reporters use binoculars.
The World Health Organization reports that hospitals in Baghdad are seeing 100 combat casualties an hour, and amputations are being performed without anesthesia or morphine.
And finally, a new audio tape purported to be Osama bin Laden was obtained by the Associated Press in Pakistan. The tape contains bin Laden's call for Muslims to rise up against Arab governments that support the attack on Iraq and urges more suicide attacks. There's no confirmation on when the recording was made or if it really is bin Laden.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest war developments.
And join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.